Hello there and welcome to this Expert HR podcast, where we'll be looking at the key cases for HR in 2019. I'm Laura Merrilees and I'm joined today by two of my colleagues here at Expert HR, Stephen Simpson and Fiona Cumming. Welcome, Stephen and Fiona.
Hi.
Hi.
Fiona, let's start with a case that's been quite controversial and has had huge significance, particularly for the social care sector, and that's the case of Royal Mencap Society and Tomlinson Blake.
Yeah, absolutely. This is very important to that sector because it's got significant financial ramifications, because it concerns the payment of care workers who sleep in overnight at their employer's premises and are called on to assist if there is an emergency or deal with an incident in the night, but otherwise they don't have any duties. And what it comes down to is whether these workers are entitled to receive the national minimum wage for all of their sleep-in shift, regardless of whether they are awake, or just in respect of the time that they spend providing assistance or undertaking duties.
Yeah, and that was Miss Tomlinson Blake's case.
Yeah, she worked sleep-in shifts from 10 p.m. to 7 a.m. and for doing that she received a flat rate payment of £22.35 plus 1 hour's pay at the national minimum wage rate. Now, she contended that she was entitled to be paid for the national minimum wage for every hour of her shift, and she brought a claim under the national minimum wage legislation.
And the tribunal agreed with her?
Yes. The tribunal rejected Mencap's argument because Mencap had argued that because she was obliged only to be available for work during the sleep-in shift, this meant that under the national minimum wage legislation, time spent asleep wouldn't count as work. But instead, in the tribunal's view, Ms. Tomlinson Blake was actually working for the whole period of her shift, and that's because she had to stay on her employer's premises, she had to have a listening ear, and she had to use her professional judgment to decide whether her assistance was necessary or not.
Yeah, and the EAT then went on to uphold the tribunal's judgment.
Yes, it did. And then the case trundled on to the Court of Appeal.
And when it got to the Court of Appeal, did they take a different view?
Yes, they overturned the tribunal's decision. And I think it's safe to say that in doing that, they also overturned quite a body of case law too. And the Court of Appeal took, in its own words, a straightforward reading of the relevant provisions in the national minimum wage legislation. And it held that only time spent awake and actually working should count for national minimum wage purposes.
Okay, so you can see why that decision's been welcomed by employers in the care sector, can't you, I suppose?
Very much so. This is because if the EAT's decision had stood, then care sector employers were facing, well, ongoing increased staffing costs and as well as claims for back pay for the previous 6 years. And it's been estimated that that would cost that sector around £400 million. And Mencap's estimated for its own purposes it would be £20 million. So it's fair to say that's a significant financial expenditure.
Absolutely, yeah.
But of course, the decision is extremely disappointing to Ms. Tomlinson Blake and to all care workers who undertake sleep-in shifts.
Yeah, but it's not likely to be the end of the matter, is it?
No, Ms. Tomlinson Blake, well, she's got the backing of Unison and she's seeking leave to appeal the Court of Appeal's decision to the Supreme Court. And Unison have said that they will do everything possible to support her in that and to reverse the decision because they think it's completely wrong. And I think it's probably safe to say it's likely that she will get leave to bring it to the Supreme Court. So really, it may not be the end of the matter. It's watch this space.
Okay. So Stephen, moving on now to a couple of cases which focus on the issue of shared parental pay. And these are the cases of Hextall and the Chief Constable of Leicestershire Police and Capita Customer Management and Ally.
Yes, so in both Ally and Hextall, the issue is basically do employers that give enhanced maternity leave also have to enhance shared parental leave? In other words, is it sex discrimination against men not to do so?
Okay, so what was the relevant Capita policy?
So in that case, the relevant policy gives mothers 14 weeks enhanced maternity pay on full pay, with the rest at the statutory maternity pay level. However, fathers are entitled to 2 weeks paternity leave on full pay, and then shared parental leave is payable at the statutory level only.
Okay, and in the case of Leicestershire Police, their policy?
So Leicestershire Police's policy is that police officers on maternity leave receive 18 weeks full pay, officers on shared parental leave are paid at the statutory minimum level only. So the case has basically revolved around whether it's discrimination for mothers to receive multiple weeks on full pay while those on shared parental leave, who realistically are mostly fathers wishing to take an extended period of leave after the birth of their child, are paid the statutory minimum.
And in the two cases that we're focusing on here, so with Mr. Ali and Mr. Hextall, are there circumstances, do you think, typical of the disputes that might arise over shared parental leave policies?
So unfortunately, there are unusual aspects to both cases that in some ways don't make them ideal test cases. In the Ali case, Mr. Ali's wife had postnatal depression, and medical advice was that returning to work would assist with her recovery. So in that case, there was actually a real need for him to take the leave, rather than it just being a preference between the couple. And then in Hextall, technically the shared parental leave regulations don't actually apply to police officers, although police forces policies do actually mirror the legislation. So in Hextall, there can't be a discussion about the purposes behind the regulations, such as encouraging childcare to be shared between both parents.
So what stage of the case is reached now?
So at first instance, the Employment Tribunal upheld Mr. Ali's direct sex discrimination claim on the basis that a policy of giving a woman on maternity leave enhanced pay, while a man who wishes to take a greater caring role gets only the statutory minimum, is founded on generalised assumptions about whom should be the primary carer. However, the EAT allowed Capita's appeal and set aside the sex discrimination finding. The EAT placed a greater emphasis on the purpose of maternity leave under EU law, which is to assist the health of the mother, and concluded that the correct comparator for Mr. Ali should have been a woman on shared parental leave who would also have been paid the statutory minimum, not a woman on maternity leave.
Okay, and in the Hextall case, what stage has that got to now?
So in that case, the Employment Tribunal dismissed both Mr. Hextall's direct and indirect discrimination claims. The direct discrimination claim was rejected because the chosen comparator, a police constable who'd given birth to a child and who is on maternity leave, is in a different position than the male police officer. And for indirect sex discrimination, the suggested provision, criterion or practice, PCP, of paying only the statutory rate of pay to those taking shared parental leave doesn't cause a particular disadvantage to men, since the police force pays both sexes the same on shared parental leave. And on appeal, the EAT agreed with the tribunal's direct discrimination finding, but did remit the indirect discrimination part of the case to a new tribunal.
And both the Ali and Hextall cases are being appealed.
That's right. So the Court of Appeal is due to hear both cases on 1st of May 2019. So we should have judgments in both cases in summer 2019.
Okay, so between now and then, in the meantime, what would your advice be, Stephen, for employers if they're trying to grapple with the issue of how they pay people on maternity leave and those on shared parental leave?
In some ways, these two cases, while important, are a bit of a distraction for employers, since they don't deal with the real issue, I think, which is justifying the policy if employers face an indirect sex discrimination claim. So my advice would be for employers that enhance maternity leave but not shared parental leave to continue to monitor the situation and look out for further case law on the potential justifications of doing so. And they should just keep a record of the rationale for the policy and evidence to show that the policy is a proportionate means of achieving a legitimate aim, remembering always that cost alone is unlikely to be a valid justification.
Of course. Fiona, let's have a look at a case now which will be before the Court of Appeal this year concerning holiday pay, which has been a bit of a saga, it's fair to say, over the past few years.
No, absolutely. Now, this is a case of Flowers and Others and East of England Ambulance Trust. It's another case about whether voluntary overtime should be taken into account in the calculation of holiday pay.
So before we look at the facts of this particular case, I think it would be helpful if we could just sort of remind our listeners of the current position on the inclusion of overtime in the calculation of holiday pay.
Yeah, so currently what should be included is guaranteed overtime and also non-guaranteed overtime. So that's where the employer is not obliged to offer overtime, but if they do so, then the employee is contractually obliged to undertake the overtime. So that should be included. And that was established in the Bear Scotland case. And then the Dudley Metropolitan Borough Council and Willetts, in that case, it was established that voluntary overtime should be included where it's sufficiently regular and settled that it would qualify as normal remuneration.
So the facts of this case are what?
Well, this case, it concerns ambulance workers at an East of England ambulance trust. Now, under their NHS terms and conditions of service, they can be required to work non-guaranteed overtime when their shifts overrun. But in addition to this non-guaranteed overtime, they can also be asked if they would like to volunteer for additional shifts. But there is no contractual obligation on workers to agree to do voluntary overtime. Now, a group of ambulance workers, they brought claims in the Employment Tribunal for unlawful deduction from wages on the basis that pay for both types of overtime should be included in the calculation of their holiday pay.
OK, and what happened then?
Well, actually, by the time of the tribunal hearing, the decision in Bear Scotland had come down, so the Trust conceded that pay for non-guaranteed overtime must be taken into account. But the tribunal took a different view on the voluntary overtime because it found that there was no contractual obligation for the ambulance workers to perform voluntary overtime, and therefore pay for voluntary overtime did not form part of the ambulance workers' normal remuneration, and they held that it should not be taken into account in the calculation of the holiday pay.
OK, but the ambulance workers then went on an appeal, didn't they?
They did, and the EAT allowed their appeal because by that time the decision in Dudley and Metropolitan Borough Council had been handed down, and the EAT was aware that the tribunal hadn't had the benefit of that decision when it made its own decision. So the EAT, they went on to reject because the Trust argued that Dudley had been wrongly interpreted, well, it had wrongly interpreted European Court of Justice case law. The EAT, they rejected that argument, and they found that the decision in Dudley was clearly right, and the EAT went on to hold that voluntary overtime must be included in the calculation of holiday pay for ambulance workers that have a pattern of voluntary overtime that is sufficiently regular and settled, you know, flowing on from Dudley. And this is where the decision may also have wider ramifications in the NHS. The EAT also took the view that in the alternative, the claimants had a contractual claim which required their contractual holiday pay to reflect all overtime pay received during the relevant reference period, and that was regardless of the regularity with which it was paid, and that has, you know, wider implications.
Absolutely. But the Trust is now appealing, isn't it? We're now going to get to the next stage of appeal, which is the Trust's appeal.
Absolutely. So the Trust is appealing to the Court of Appeal, and the Court is due to hear the appeal before the end of October this year. Now, the decision, Dudley, that I mentioned, that was an EAT case. So this would be the first time that the issue of voluntary overtime is going to a higher court, to the Court of Appeal. So again, a decision of interest to look out for this year, which will have ramifications.
So looking now at the issue of the enforceability of restrictive covenants, Stephen, and this is the case of Tillman and Egon Zehnder.
Yes, so Tillman involved a senior employee within financial services firm Egon Zehnder wishing to take up employment with a US company. However, a restrictive covenant in her contract of employment stipulated that she should not directly or indirectly engaged or be concerned or interested in any business carried on in competition for 6 months after she left Egon Zehnder.
Okay, so that sort of being engaged or interested in, it's obvious that we're talking about a very wide restrictive covenant here.
Yes, so it was argued that it not only prevented her from working for a competitor for 6 months, but that the words concerned or interested in prevented her from being even a shareholder in a competitor.
Yeah, now she obviously wanted to move on with her employment, so she sought to have that restrictive covenant set aside.
Yes, so she argued in the High Court that the non-compete clause was unenforceable. However, the High Court enforced the clause, meaning that she couldn't work for the US firm for the six-month period. Looking at the contract of employment as a whole, the High Court thought that the restrictive covenant was not intended to cover holding shares in other companies. That's because another clause in the contract expressly permitted a 5% shareholding in competing businesses.
Okay, but she went on to appeal the decision, and the Court of Appeal upheld her appeal.
Yes, the Court of Appeal interpreted the phrase interested in using its everyday natural meaning and concluded that this could include a person holding shares in a company. This meant that the clause was too wide and had to be set aside in its entirety, meaning that Ms. Tillman was free to work for the US firm.
And the Supreme Court's due to consider the case this year in a further appeal, isn't it?
Yes, it's scheduled to hear the employer's appeal on 21st and 22nd of January. So we should get a judgment around about Easter.
And why is this case so important for employers to look out for?
So really, the drafting of restrictive covenants is a notoriously difficult area for employers, and it's hoped that the Supreme Court will provide some guidance on the drafting and interpretation of restrictive covenants, particularly the issue of whether or not they're unenforceable in their entirety if they're drafted too widely.
So Fiona, moving into a different area concerning the unions, and we're talking about a case here where the employer attempts to bypass collective bargaining and negotiate directly with its employees.
Yes, this is a case of Costal UK Limited and Dunkley and others. Now, briefly, the facts are that the employer and the trade union Knight, they had been engaged in negotiating a pay deal and related changes to terms and conditions. Now, Unite told Costal that it could not recommend the proposed pay package to its members, but it would ballot them and give them a free vote, which it did, and the members rejected it. Now, what the company then did was to write directly to each and every employee saying that a failure to agree to the terms would lead to no Christmas bonus and no pay increase that year. Now, the company then sent a second letter to the employees who had not yet accepted the terms, stating that if no agreement could be reached, this may lead to the company serving notice on your contract of employment. And a number of Unite members, obviously unhappy with this, they brought claims to the Employment Tribunal, arguing that the company had breached their rights under Section 145B of the Trade Union and Labour Relations Consolidation Act 1992.
If you could just remind us, Fiona, of what the effect of that Section 145B is, because it is an important provision, isn't it?
No, absolutely. Well, in its most basic terms, what this section does is prohibit an employer from making an offer to workers and workers who are members of a trade union, and the offer being effectively an inducement, which, if accepted, would result in the employees giving up any or all of their collective bargaining rights.
Okay, so what did the tribunal decide in this case?
Well, the tribunal, it rejected Costal's defence. Now, Costal had argued that it never intended to cease collective bargaining and that the offer was just a temporary measure to solve the impasse. But from the tribunal's viewpoint, they thought it was extremely improbable that Costal had not intended to bypass the collective bargaining process. And the tribunal went on to hold that it's just not permissible for an employer to abandon collective negotiations when it does not like the result of a ballot and to approach individual employees directly.
And the real sting in the tail with this case is the remedy, isn't it? What remedy did the tribunal go on to award?
Well, the penalty for a breach of Section 145B, it's set annually, and at that time it was £3,800. So what the tribunal did was, it went on to make an award to each claimant of £3,800 for each inducement offer. So this meant that, well, the claimants who had received the two letters would receive two awards, giving them a total award of £7,600.
Gosh. Unsurprisingly then, Costal appealed the tribunal decision on liability and remedy to the EAT, didn't it?
Yes, but unsuccessfully. The EAT said that Section 145B, it doesn't stop employers from making direct offers to employees, but that's when collective bargaining has broken down and the employer has a proper purpose. But the EAT, they made clear that what Section 145B does prevent is an employer going over the heads of the union with direct offers to workers in order to achieve the result that one or more terms will not be then be determined by collective agreement with the union if their offers are accepted.
And I believe that the EAT made it clear that it doesn't matter whether the employer is intending to do this as a temporary arrangement or a permanent surrender of collective bargaining, the effect will still be the same.
Yeah, absolutely, they were clear about that.
And on the remedy, no luck for the employer there in terms of the award that was made?
Well, no, because the EAT agreed with the tribunal and it said that Section 145B, it requires tribunals to make an award in respect of the offer complained of, and the tribunal had found that there were two distinct offers.
But it's not the end of the matter.
No, Costal is appealing the decision to the Court of Appeal, and the appeal, it's going to be heard in May this year.
It'll be particularly interesting to keep an eye out for that decision because it'll be the first time that an appellate court has looked at this Section 145B, so it'll be a key decision when that comes through.
Yeah, absolutely.
But in the meantime, we have this decision of the EAT. What would you say it means for employers?
Well, employers that have got unionised workforces where they must not make direct offers to employees with the intention of restricting or bypassing an ongoing collective bargaining process. But it should be said that employers also should be extremely cautious about making a direct approach to employees, even if collective bargaining has broken down and they consider that they have a proper and lawful purpose. And this is because, well, as we can see from this case, the financial ramifications can be huge if an employer gets it wrong. And if the Court of Appeal upholds this tribunal judgment, well, Costell's looking at a total award of around £420,000, so big money.
Yeah, so the risk is not insignificant. Mm. So turning now to a Spanish case, which has implications for UK employers, and this involves the covert monitoring of employees.
Yes, so in Lopez, Ribalda and others, and Spain, a supermarket in Spain suspected that staff were stealing and installed visible cameras at entrances and exits. However, the supermarket also installed hidden cameras at the checkouts to monitor what staff were doing.
Okay, and what did the covert footage reveal?
So the footage from the hidden cameras showed a number of workers stealing and helping customers and colleagues to steal stock as well. Not surprisingly, this resulted in the workers being dismissed.
Indeed, but the workers challenged the employer's actions in terms of that CCTV monitoring in court.
Yes, the Spanish domestic court found that while their dismissals were fair, the employees were not informed of the installation of the covert surveillance or of their rights under Spain's Data Protection Act.
Okay. The workers then took their case, though, to the European Court of Human Rights.
Which found that the employer's constant and widespread covert CCTV breached the workers' right to privacy under Article 8 of the European Convention on Human Rights.
So this is clearly a problematic decision for employers, isn't it?
Of course, yes. So common sense dictates that a company that's suffering losses because of thefts should be entitled to carry out covert surveillance, at least until the culprits are caught and the situation improves. If the company had told staff about the CCTV on the tills, the thefts may simply have stopped and the culprits might never have been caught.
Absolutely, but this case, it doesn't necessarily preclude employers from using covert CCTV to detect crime or serious misconduct, does it?
No, I think it's important to say that this case is somewhat fact-specific, particularly given how widespread and constant the surveillance was. Employers are still likely to be able to justify covert CCTV in very limited circumstances, for example, where the employer has a reasonable suspicion that a crime or serious misconduct is taking place, and where CCTV use is likely to be a proportionate means of securing evidence or preventing further crime or serious misconduct.
Yeah, now of course we need to look at all of the sort of the CCTV usage within the confines of the GDPR, don't we? And there are GDPR implications as well with CCTV.
Yes, so while the GDPR and human rights laws run independently of each other, complying with the GDPR should go a long way towards preventing employers from breaching workers' human rights when they use CCTV. For example, under the GDPR, a data protection impact assessment is required when carrying out large-scale systematic monitoring of a publicly accessible place. The impact assessment should help employers to identify whether or not CCTV is necessary and proportionate, and it should also help employers to identify specific issues, such as exactly where the cameras will be located, when they will be recording, and for how long the covert CCTV will be installed for.
Okay, so that's good practical advice that employers can use, at least if they face themselves with this situation. But in terms of the Lopez-Ribalda case, are we still waiting to hear more on this? What stage has it reached?
So the case is actually still in the European Court of Human Rights, having been heard on 28th of November by the Grand Chamber panel, which is a kind of final appeal stage within the European Court of Human Rights. So employers are awaiting the final decision from that panel.
Fiona, very briefly, I don't think we can finish up this podcast without talking about the whole saga of employee worker status cases, which has, you know, dominated this area for the past couple of years or so. And just before Christmas, we had the Court of Appeal judgment in the Uber case, didn't we?
We did indeed. And the Court of Appeal upheld the tribunal and the EAT decision that Uber drivers are workers. But it seems that, yes, Uber will continue to be in the employment law headlines this year because the Court of Appeal gave Uber leave to appeal to the Supreme Court. And because the Court of Appeal's decision was a majority decision, Uber believed that one of the justices got it right, and they're saying that they confirmed that they will be appealing to the Supreme Court. So watch the space.
Absolutely, we'll keep a keen eye out for that. Well, thanks very much, Fiona and Stephen. And to link through to the cases we've been talking about today, do go to our Law Reports tool, where you'll find all the details, including the full report and the high-level implications. Well, that brings us to the end of this Expert HR podcast. Thanks for listening, and we look forward to you joining us again next time.